Welcome, everyone. My name is Tim Mikelashvili, and I'm the host of the All Out Coach podcast. We're live today on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube as well. I'm co-founder of Amadev Pharma, a performance analytics agency that's focused on a sports and science formula to improve engagement and quantify the impact of medical teams in life science companies, pharma and biotech. All Out Coach is a podcast which I call a classroom of sorts, in which we share inspiration in order to continue to research questions by not just scratching, but going beneath the surface in leadership and company culture, mentorship, and pharma as well. Today, I have a special guest. His name is Stefano Puntoni. He is Sebastian Kresge, professor of marketing at the Wharton School. Prior to his current appointment, he taught marketing at the Rotterdam School at Erasmus University. He received his PhD in marketing at the London Business School and also his statistics degree at the Università degli Studi di Padova in Italy. And I recently came across his webinar, MIT Sloan, which really inspired me to learn about the difference between data-driven analytics and decision-driven data. And so we'll talk about a new look of decision-driven data with purpose today with Dr. Stefano Puntoni. Stefano, welcome to All Our Coach. So glad to have you here.
Hi, Tim. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Sure. So Sebastian Kresge, for those of you who may not know, was the founder of a retail store that became known as Kmart. And you have a very rich and diverse history based on your training and education and your journey personally. And also, I know that the University of Padova has a long history, is a cradle for modern medicine and also the center of scientific renaissance as well. So I want to ask you about what inspired you to study both human behavior, because you're a behavioral scientist in marketing, and also data science and statistics as well.
When I was in high school, you know, you may relate to this, and you don't know what to do, and you're thinking about what should I study. Some people know, you know, from the start, they want to be a doctor, they want to be whatever, police. But I didn't know. But there was one thing that I really liked to do, and I thought that was going to be it, and that was architecture. So I wanted to be an architect. And the problem was, this was still, you know, quite a few years ago, and there was still this belief that you needed to be good at the hand drawing when you do architecture. And I'm really terrible. I can't draw really bad. And so I was advised against the field of architecture. And at that point, I didn't know what to do. So I decided to buy myself time. So I was thinking, what could I study that you can apply in a lot of different domains? And I ended up doing statistics. And so at the end of the studies, I still didn't know what to do. And at that point, I really needed to figure it out. And I actually took a market research course as part of my elective. And I found really fascinating. I started thinking about how people make decisions. And from there, I transitioned into decision science, decision making, and marketing. The interesting thing is, only maybe a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago or so, I finally had the realization of why I went into marketing and what I found interesting. And it happened to be the same thing that I found interesting in architecture. So once I said, okay, I'm not going to be doing architecture, I ended up in a field that I think has some important similarities, although it doesn't seem like it. I think what they both share, both architecture and marketing, share the fact that they are disciplines that stimulate both sides of the brain. So if you are an architect, you need to build a house, you know, structurally sound, you know, it's be close to engineering. But at the same time, it's not only about that. It's also about making the house beautiful and different and enticing for people to want to live in. And marketing is a bit like that, meaning there's a lot of data analytics. You should inform your decisions with data. At the same time, you know, it needs to stand out. It needs to be creative. It needs to be different. And so I think it's this nice combination of hard data and science with also creativity and you know, something a bit different that that I found interesting. Yeah.
Combining both abstract and the exact sciences. And, you know, I haven't spoken to many of my commercial colleagues in pharma including in sales, they've definitely told me and explained to me how marketing is definitely much more analytical field as well. So it makes sense to me, you know, Stefano. So to be innovative, you know, you mentioned creativity. I think we don't only have to identify solutions that our customers or market thinks that they need, but maybe identify the unspoken needs or unarticulated problems that may hide beneath the surface, and which requires a careful observation of the human condition, which you have studied extensively throughout your career. So I want to ask you, how do most innovative brands or companies identify those new unspoken needs of the market?
You know, if you take a marketing course in college, you know, many of you have done that. And one key concept that you are going to hear a lot about is market orientation. So the idea will be that companies will be more successful when they are market oriented. And by that, we usually mean that you're going to respond to customer preferences. So essentially, instead of just being in your office thinking about what do I want to do and just do that, you're going to ask people, what do you think that I should do, and then do that. So you're more responsive to customer preferences. So that's the idea of market orientation, of being oriented towards the market. Now, the thing is, the way we understand this concept is often, and I think, you know, professors are part of the problem because that's how we tend to teach it. The problem is that we tend to think of the concept in a way that is rather reactive. So there are preferences out there, and I'm going to react to those preferences. That's the way we tend to think about market orientation. So it's almost like you're always chasing yesterday's preferences, right? And there is a different way of thinking about market orientation, which is maybe best exemplified by Apple, I would say, where you're going to say, not necessarily what it is that they say they want, but a deeper understanding of what it is that they want, although they didn't ask for it because they don't even know that's possible. You know, the famous, probably not true quote by Henry Ford, that if I had asked what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, right? But they didn't know that they could have had a car instead. And the same goes for things like the iPhone, or, you know, everybody making fun of the idea of making a phone. Why? Well, you didn't understand it wasn't going to be a phone, actually. Or the iPod, where now you can, you know, earlier they had that, the transition to digital music, essentially. And so here, this market orientation gets interpreted a bit differently. It is a distinction between being market-driven and being market-driving. So the extent to which you respond to the market, you're actively responding to things going on to the market, versus you are driving the change in the market. And so oftentimes you hear in strategy things like blue ocean strategy or you know, concepts like that, which are about trying to escape competitive structures and do something different. And so typically, if you take this market orientation view or market orientation, which is more forward-looking, more market driving, this is where you're going to find the more radical innovations, the bigger bucks, in terms of creating new customer benefits or create vastly better customer benefits or create bad customer benefits without necessarily having some, downside, for example, a high price. How can you deliver those to people in a way that just makes a big difference? Mm-hmm. So, how do you do that? It takes a deep understanding of the customer, right? You need to understand what it is that they're trying to achieve. And although they might not verbalize a desire in that direction, you need to be able to have the insight to understand that a particular technology or process could do that for them in a way that is better than current technologies. Mm-hmm.
So in a typical modern company, you have the expert who knows the numbers, and then you have one who best understands the problem of the market, the customers. And yeah. I think you verbalized this so eloquently at the webinar, at the MIT Sloan webinar that I attended late last year, where you said that you need to be able to create the bridge between the person who best understands the problem and one who best understands the numbers. How are we able to combine those kinds of two skill sets?
I think it's maybe the biggest issue in analytics. I mean, if you think about analytics, often people tend to think about technical challenges. Mm-hmm. I don't think technical challenges are really the main challenge. They're obviously also technical challenges, but those largely, can be addressed with attention and investment. I think the bigger issue is how to make it work. And the problem is that on one hand, the technical skills involved in analytics, especially with large data sets and complex, things like AI, I think it's becoming way beyond the grasp of the average executive manager, who shouldn't be expected to be a technical specialist, given that they are a domain expert. And so now you have this chasm being, growing between the people who handle the data and the people who make the decisions. And that's a problem. That's a problem because then you end up not having good communication. You end up having, poor linking of analysis with decisions. And this is what you see in a lot of companies. So I think you need to create companies to try to create teams that involve domain expert, someone who knows what we're trying to achieve, mm-hmm. and what is possible and what is desirable and blah, blah, blah. We need to have analytics experts who can actually get the job done, pull the data, figure out what to do with it, and come back with some answers. And then we need to have a person who can help with the translation, maybe. So a person who has, enough technical expertise to be able to really understand the implications of certain, decisions for the data part, but at the same time is able to translate what the manager is talking about and what it means to the analyst. The problem is you end up with a manager who knows nothing about the data. The data is someone with a technical, background in econometrics or statistics. They've got no clue whatsoever about the business, that the problem that they're trying to support or help solve. And now you are in a situation where they can't talk to each other. And also there could be, the manager is not happy, feels that the analyst is kind of like pointless, is never coming with useful stuff. The analyst feels these guys, have no clue, and they are asking ridiculous questions. And so you have this also tension that build up from the lack of communication. But I think ideally you have a person there in the middle who can help transfer information, align incentives and behavior. So what kind of people like that? These are people that can be trained in business schools. Like every business school has initiated a master's in business analytics. So these are people who have some ideas about, say, marketing or finance or operations or whatever, the domain of application. But at the same time, they can code, basic machine learning models, and they know what a data lake is and how do we deal with certain data issues. And then mm-hmm. they can really help support both sides of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there particular types of companies or industries that do this better than others, based on your observations? Is there a role that's like DevOps, for example, right, which kind of merges both operations and development, let's say, in software?
Yeah, so you see a lot of companies that are doing quite well. And by this point, the analytics kind of revolution, you can say, has gone far for long enough that a lot of large organizations are getting their act together. And I've been talking mm-hmm. to companies like, say, Unilever, for example. I think they're mm-hmm. Quite impressive. I was talking the other day with the head of analytics on Mars. I think I was quite impressed with what they were doing there. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of companies, when you talk to them, they've been going quite far. Otherwise, the more tech-oriented companies will be those that typically have been there first and have been, they will look at how Google is using consultative selling to support clients. They're not just selling them a solution, but they actively advise them on how to best use the tool. So they want to make sure that the clients can get the best, bang for the buck.
Yeah. Yeah. So decisions and decision-making, rather, is a science. Right. Ian Brown, a Stanford professor, said that, you can't base decisions on outcomes alone. And so you really have to study them because, look, if you drive after you have, let's say, had two or three glasses of wine and you drive home and you get home safe, that doesn't mean that that's a good decision to drink. Right. For example, we also may have to make timely decisions. So my question is, what do we need to consider to make the right decisions at the most timely manner and at the right time?
I think you are referring to something that is very important, which is in decision making, really, we are often too much influenced by the decision outcome. So basically, we make a decision, then the chips fall where they may, and then we observe an outcome. And then we judge how well you made a decision purely based on how well you ended up. Did you make, mm-hmm. Did you make the sales you want to make? You reach the targets you wanted to. Right. And oftentimes we fail to realize that those outcomes are driven by a lot of other factors that have nothing to do with what you decided or not decided to do. So there is this famous paper where they showed that the bonuses of CEOs of energy companies are basically highly correlated with the price of crude. So basically, you know, you have a market which swings up and down based on forces that nobody fully understands. And then you have a decision maker at the helm making decisions that basically being largely influenced by those up and down swings, which they have no role. But in the end, they get the big bonuses if the price went up and they went, you know, they don't get the bonuses if the price went down. Although when it went up, it wasn't their benefit, you know, it wasn't their, you know, credit. And when it went down, it wasn't their fault either. So, you know, we should really move away from outcomes and we should think about process. Process is key. What is a good decision process? So I value process over outcome any day. If I see a person that makes a decision in a very smart way, and then the outcome is negative because maybe they weren't lucky, then I think that person is much better decision making than a person who just happened to be lucky and made the person decision, got the jackpot. You know, so if you got the jackpot this time, then probably not gonna get it next time. So, so I think that's crucial to really think carefully about decision process, and especially when you are under a lot of time pressure. I think that's really important that you thought beforehand. What is the appropriate set of steps you're going to take in order to make decisions, because you know you will not have time to sit in long meetings and you know decide altogether what it is that you're going to do. You need to have some kind of decision templates, some kind of approaches that you know are leading to reasonably good decisions. And most companies don't need the 100% right decision. They need to make decisions 80% right. So at some point,
great point.
At some point, we say, yeah, I can't spend another 2 months on this and give you the perfect answer. But by that time, there's no point giving the answer in the first place because the training has passed. So then, you know, make a decision today, let's make the best. So it's a trade off between speed and accuracy, and you need to be comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we can't speak about decisions without also talking about intuition as well. It's personal curiosity that I want to ask you about, what you know, for your opinion. Albert Einstein, of course, said that the intuitive mind is a sacred gift and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We've created a society that honors the servant but has forgotten the gift. So how can we train our intuition? Is it possible at all to make better decisions, Stefano?
It is possible, but it's not easy. There is quite a lot of effort in that direction in recent years, no work that I've done. But if you think about it, you know, we've evolved with intuitive responses to certain problems or certain situations for a reason. We evolved with those strategies because they were adaptive. They helped us survive. They helped us, you know, propagate our species. So those intuitions are there for a reason. It's important to keep that in mind. However, those intuitions are also limited in the extent to which they might be sometimes used in situations where they're not appropriate. When instead, it's, you know, it takes more deliberation to make a good decision. And here in the behavioral science, you really have two, you know, strands of work. One strand that points out the decision biases, like all the mistakes that we make, you know, the systematic mistakes that we make in making decisions, you know, being predictably irrational, as you know, Dan Ariely wrote. Another strand that says, you know, how does instead the intuition help us make good decisions? And the first, it's tend to be associated with the Kahneman and Tversky and the famous, you know, prospect theory and all of that. And that kind of work does highlight all the ways in which we are stupid, you know, which way we make inferences that are not warranted. And we, you know, overweight this and underweight there. And of course, we can learn about that. So although a lot of those tendencies are, you could argue, even hardwired, I think there are ways in which you can try to improve the way that you make decisions. For example, by, you know, avoiding situations that we know or make people more successful to biases and ensuring that you have the right type of information to make decisions that avoid these biases, or using more formalistic approaches. For example, sometimes it might benefit to use an Excel file and make sure that you integrate information formally rather than just, you know, a gut feeling, because you're probably going to be biased towards certain things that we know we are biased towards. So these are all ways in which you can do it. There are other ways in which you can help train. This is part of the job of business schools. So when you take go to do an MBA, there will be quite a lot of attention into how to improve decision making in contexts like negotiation or in analytics or finance or whatever. And a lot of that is about this, about how to train your say system two, so to speak, to overwrite system one or avoid getting into biases. But there are other ways. People have looked at the experiential approaches, for example, serious games like things where, you know, the military has been developing things like that, where you get, you know, soldiers into some kind of simulated game, some game where basically would they help you reduce certain tendencies we all have, like, you know, confirmation bias or other tendencies like that. So certainly there's a lot of stuff that can be done.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, just being prepared, I have a lot of domain knowledge can help. So one of my favorite scientists is Louis Pasteur, a French guy, the one who invented vaccine.
Sure. Yeah.
And he said, luck favors the prepared mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fleming, you know the story with the antibiotics, with the mold. So Fleming was in his lab and just stumbled into a fungus that was able to kill bacteria. But if I was sitting in the same lab, I would not have noticed anything strange. But he was Fleming, and he could understand what was going on. So I think luck favors a prepared mind. And I think that's useful to keep in mind. There's a lot of stochastic error in the world. You know, there's a lot of randomness everywhere. But I think, you know, being prepared is still useful. It's not like we should give up on being better decision makers because you can't predict anything. You can, you know, you can make a difference.
Right. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that example. So you mentioned, I think in passing, gut feelings. And so Gerd Gigerenzer, actually is the right pronunciation, I believe, who's the author of the book Gut Feelings, The Intelligence of the Subconscious. He's also the director of the Max Planck Institute for Human Development. He defines intuition as instinctively knowing what to discard and what is not essential. And based on your comments just now, you need a certain level or standard of domain expertise in order to be able to do that as a human, not even introducing AI or technology yet, which I know we're going to get to. And so my question really is, how do you utilize technology to make the right decisions to your target audience? Let's say if you have your eyes set on the best advertising campaign, let's say, to date, you know, in the modern era that you want to, you know, develop for your company. How can you, you know, utilize AI, being a domain expert, but just being able to process more data at once, let's say, to your target audience?
Gigerenzer is actually the person who's most famous for the second view of behavioral science that I was mentioning earlier, or the view that actually these intuitions are adaptive. They are very good. They often correlate very highly with actually correct solutions, even when you elaborate more. And it's interesting you make the context of advertising. Advertising is a funny beast because on the one hand, it's very easy to advertise. You know, so everybody can do it easily, right? You know, what does it take to make an account on Facebook for business and just set out a campaign? You know, anyone can do it. At the same time, do it well is incredibly difficult. It's one of those business activities where the barrier to it, the bar to start doing advertising is basically zero, but where the number of people that really know what they're doing and they do it very well is actually very small. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that you basically are basically sending out messages in a very noisy environment. People are exposed to all kinds of information. They make decisions for all kinds of reasons. And you basically are trying to swing their behavior, make sure that they, for example, you know, consider your medication or treatment or whatever. But, you know, they might be reading a lot of other information, or they might be taking a particular treatment for all kinds of reasons. And so the difficulty there is to understand the impact that advertising has on people. And if you look at digital advertising, which was always held the promise of making advertising more measurable, all of a sudden we can track, you know, what's happening with your advertising. So this was always a promise of digital advertising. The problem is that in the end, it still becomes very difficult. You know, you are doing 20 different things to the customer. You send them an email, you call them up, you have a doctor visiting, a detail appointment and go to their office. You are posting something on LinkedIn. You are pushing out some white paper and you're doing the Facebook campaign and all of that happened at the same time. And not only you, all your competitors are doing the same. And then people have their own random things. And today they feel this way for that reason. Tomorrow they'll feel another way for another reason. And it's all very complicated. So you observe outcomes, but it's very difficult to trace back what created that outcome in the first place. And that is true today, pretty much the same that it was true in the time of purely TV advertising. Right? So, you know, algorithms can help. So the targeting algorithms of the big platforms are incredible. You know, that you can select on very specific audience, for example, demographic variables or interests, you know, people who like this. And so you're able to have a very granular audience. And not only that, you can observe outcome. You know whether someone clicked on the ad, you know, things like that. The problem is that it might engender a bit of a short-term mindset. You know, now it's all about clicking on the ad.
Yeah.
And it's all about targeting this very narrow demographic that you know, people who liked your competing podcast or whatever.
Right.
And the issue is that in advertising is really good at feeding the top of this the funnel, of the sales funnel. It's all about getting people aware, you know, building a brand, making people aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it and what you're doing. And so that's more about brand building than it is about conversion or short-term, you know, behavior optimization and activation. So I think it's important that even in this new digital environment, we keep a bit more of a longer-term mindset and think about, you know, how do we build a brand online? It's not all about, you know, stimulating click, click, click. I don't think about that. It's also not about reaching the same very narrow demographic. Maybe people narrow too, you know, target too narrowly. You know, that's my impression. But because Facebook give you this 1 million parameters on which you can restrict an audience, you end up restricting it too much. And maybe what you really should be doing is to just go broader and see if you can find new audiences for the content.
Yeah. In the healthcare context, I know a lot of my colleagues are now you know, experimenting with medical education programs that are delivered online. And they're bombarded with so many different metrics that they need to learn how to interpret, where views of a pharma-sponsored medical education program may be defined as 3 seconds. So my question really is, how, you know, how can you really reinforce learning or ensure, validate that learning takes place if you just base your outcomes on the number of attendees or number of viewers, right? So,
no, actually, for a context like pharma, I think there is a lot to be said about more involved kind of programs where you would create, for example, problem-based learning opportunities where you would get people around the table, around an expert, discuss a case, and learn from that, rather than just, you know, some kind of random post or Yeah, you probably need a combination of things. You don't think you need one thing, you need many things. But certainly what you want to do is to have those contact moments that enable you to really bring across a message, considering especially the complexity of of the topic.
Yeah, you mentioned problem-based learning, and there are incredible success stories using that approach, actually out of England, and using WhatsApp in emergency care medicine environment as well. Which have led to, you know, incredible patient outcomes as well. So, I appreciate, you know, that context. And, you know, this is an area, of course, in which I'm just observing as an amateur, as a dilettante. You know, I mean, I've seen over the last few years, for example, getting back to healthcare again, you know, certain different types of companies that have figured out the algorithms, the advertising algorithms. And they have also leveraged or taken advantage of many patients as well, unfortunately, who seek access to care and who have that SEO algorithm. And when you type in health insurance marketplace, for example, they're the first ones that come up, but they don't offer that many benefits, and they end up, you know, deceiving lots of potential patients as well.
No, like persuasion and persuasion and understanding how people think and behave. It's a tool, and like any tool, you can use it for good things and for bad things. You know, there is nothing intrinsically good or bad about advertising, for example. It's just a matter of what you advertise and how you do it.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for making that statement. I've spent all my career in the medical field where you don't promote products, you educate. However, I've always found something to promote and be excited about in term from a scientific perspective, and always been inspired by sales and marketing colleagues of mine. I also want to make, you know, want to let you know that as well, as in terms of my my approach, my perspective on it. And I completely agree with that. But you know, I know you've studied the psychology of consumer behavior. So there's probably something to be said about how the consumers interpret that data, right? You know, who may not know that information, who may not have deep knowledge, firsthand knowledge, how to best make better decisions.
I mean, in the health domain in particular, the U.S. market is unique in that direct-to-consumer advertising is obviously allowed, and that's not the case in most other markets. So that means that here the consumer perspective is actually much more important than for example, in Europe, where really it's all about, you know, the physician's perspective. You know, this the physician is a massive gatekeeper. Of course, here too, but here there's a lot of pull marketing, where, you know, just open any TV channel. It's quite amazing how much, what the share of advertising that is actually found. I think if you are a consumer, it's, you know, the usual things. You should try to seek out, you know, reliable and unbiased information. And it may be harder to do it in some way today than other times, meaning there's so much information out there. It might actually become difficult to sort through it. My advice is always to seek out voices that are independent and hopefully unbiased. Those will be advocacy groups, things like consumer reports or people you can trust, for example, your physician. And hopefully you'll be able to make a better decision that way. You can also look at what other consumers say. You know, reviews can be important, especially for things that relate to experiential aspects of care. But you also need to realize that consumer reviews is quite a bit of work showing that the signal value of consumer reviews is fairly limited, that the correlation with the objective quality of a service or a product is often quite weak, and that if you don't have a very large number of reviews, it's actually junk data. So it's so noisy, you can't really draw any conclusion. Mm-hmm. In fact, this paper, a former PhD student of mine, that shows that if you look at Amazon reviews, the correlation between true quality as measured by consumer report objective testing and the star ratings on Amazon, that correlation is positive and significant, but it's just as strong as the correlation between the price and the star. And the correlation is positive, meaning that people rate higher things that cost more. So in a way, you could argue that based on those findings, you won't increase your star ratings on Amazon, you can actually work very hard and improve the product, or you can just increase the price. and you expected to obtain similar results. So that's kind of stark.
Stefano, we're just about out of time, but I do want to ask you about an exciting new initiative that you're embarking on now. And at the All Out Coach podcast, my slogan really is stretch yourself, lift others. So I want to ask you how you're stretching yourself and lifting others currently in your latest project.
Yeah, so I recently relocated to the United States. I moved to Philadelphia last summer with my family. So it's been quite a big change and a lot of things to learn and get used to. And one of the reasons for making the move was the exciting possibility to build here at the Wharton School a new research initiative, we call it, called the Impact of Technology Initiative. And I'm a co-director together with Bob Mayer, another professor in the marketing department. And the goal of the initiative is to promote and stimulate behavioral science work on technology. And this could be in the area of algorithms and devices and other areas as well, across different verticals, consumption, workplace, health, and communication. And so what we're trying to do here is to create for a portal and then events and activities, maybe some tailored more towards researchers, more tailored towards other stakeholders, for example, business owners, and create events and basically make sure that the research that we do has the biggest impact that it can have. So that's how I'm stretching. I'm stretching right now.
Great. I think I'm glad that you mentioned it. It's called the Impact on Technology, right?
Impact of technology.
And it's open to the public, to the industries, right? Across industries. It's industry agnostic, I imagine.
Correct? Yeah, so we are going to launch the website in a matter of weeks. So we have a beta version. We're still tweaking, but essentially we're getting there. And then there will be on the portal, there will be a link to all kinds of researchers within the Wharton School that do work on behavioral science and technology, featuring latest research, interviews with authors, and then new events. And then I will see what we can build from there.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping that many of my colleagues who listen to this podcast, whether they're in the pharma industry, in drug devices and biotech, will also participate, will follow up with you, Stefano, and hopefully we will also share each other's voices, right? And in this very important global initiative that you are embarking on. So congratulations. I wish you lots of luck. And thank you again for being my guest here. Stefano, for those of you who have listened, share this podcast with your friends and connect with Stefano Pontoni on LinkedIn, across social media as well.
Thank you very much, Tim, for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you.